Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. New Year celebrations often come with remembrances and lists of goals and dreams for the future. It's early 2022, and there's no time like now to think through ways to enhance your health, especially if you're part of the aging baby boomer population. But the recommendations we'll hear today apply to anyone from baby boomer on down, because they plant the seed of good health habits that can make life less complicated and lead to less suffering as you get older. My guest is Dr. Leslie Kernison, a geriatrician and consultant who practices in the Bay Area. Dr. Kernison is the founder of the web resource betterhealthwhileaging.net, which offers informative posts and videos on an array of healthcare topics, primarily centered around navigating the perils of aging. She's also the founder of the Geri Tech blog, which looks at technological tools that can help aging patients. Dr. Leslie Kernison, geriatrician, consultant, blogger, and founder of betterhealthwhileaging.net, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Leslie Kernison, welcome back to Medical Monday. You wrote this really nice post about ideas for healthier aging in 2022, and I thought it would just be great for our listenership if we could just go through some of them. And there's nowhere better to start, perhaps, than with COVID-19. So you have a recommendation about getting COVID vaccinated and boosted. Can you unpack that a little bit for us and clarify your recommendation?
Sure. I mean, I think that is the one that is going to be most familiar to people. But yes, vaccines, I think what most older adults maybe don't realize is that the older people are, the more vaccines seem to be protective when we look at the data. So I have been encouraging our readers at Better Health While Aging for the whole year to get vaccinated. And once the boosters came out, the data was pretty good for boosters as well. And so I encourage that as well.
I've never experienced in my medical career the specificity with which people seem to approach this. Say, well, have you had Pfizer? Have you had Moderna? Have you had J&J? Do you sort of care which one people get as long as they get vaccinated?
Well, I would say that the mRNA vaccines have worked better, Pfizer and Moderna. And then from the beginning, I thought Moderna was a better bet for older adults, because we know that as the immune system ages, it takes a stronger vaccine to kind of generate a response. That's why we have a high-dose flu shot for older adults. And so from the beginning, you could see that Moderna had 100 micrograms instead of Pfizer's 30 and a little longer interval. And I sort of felt like, well, at the beginning, people didn't have a lot of choice. But you know, if I were to pick for most of my older patients, I would pick Moderna. So I think that's good. And the booster is probably a little stronger too. But again, either one of them is pretty good. And both are better than Johnson & Johnson.
Okay, I'll ask you to extrapolate here, because this is a question I get a lot. Am I going to need a fourth booster and a fifth booster? What do you think about that?
I think it's going to depend on a couple things. I think it's going to depend, first of all, on whether they develop something for Omicron or something that's kind of pan-coronavirus. I know there are researchers working on that. And I think it's also going to depend on, as a society, whether we decide that our highest priority is to try to, you know, reduce transmission overall, which is what boosters help with, versus reduce hospitalization. It's not clear to me that for most older adults, a fourth booster is going to reduce their hospitalization risk all that much, unless they're, you know, really frail and vulnerable. So we'll have to wait and see on the data, or maybe we'll end up kind of the way we are with the flu shot, where once a year, people will get, you know, a shot to protect them against, you know, COVID over the coming 6 months.
Okay. We get to move away from COVID. Hooray!
Hooray!
And, these next couple.
And people can hear about COVID in so many places. So.
Oh yes, oh yes. Well, we had to lead with that, but now we're gonna put it aside for now. So the next two are sort of paired. You recommend focusing on leg strength and balance, and then recommending that people walk more. So leg strength and balance. What's the best way to go about it, and why?
This is a key factor in fall prevention. So what we know is that older adults become even more likely to fall if their legs are weak or if their balance is poor. Now, a lot of older people think that just if they walk regularly, that is enough. But for most people, walking by itself is not enough to really build up leg strength and doesn't challenge your balance enough. So this is especially important for older adults who have fallen or at higher risk for falls. They want to not only walk, but do exercises that are specifically building up that leg strength and balance. And this was shown in a clinically proven fall prevention program that was called Otago, based on the city of New Zealand. It was developed there. And there are other fall prevention programs based on similar exercises. But for a while, the CDC was promoting Otago. They're not doing it as much right now. But on Better Health While Aging, we have a page where we show videos showing the different exercises. And I like that as an example to show people, here are the kinds of things that you can do that work this. So for instance, for balance, people can, you know, even just walking heel to toe with a hand along the wall, that's challenging for balance, and that can help. And then walking is good just to get out and about enough. Super important, especially right now with COVID. It's actually a relatively safe way to socialize, even in COVID times, is when you're walking outside. And so I always want to remind people to make sure they're getting enough walking in as well.
Okay, so walking's not enough, but you can do these leg strengthening and balance exercises. But given whatever baseline walking you do or how little, it's probably a good idea to walk more. It's safe and good during COVID times. Okay, the next pair, the way my brain works, actually it's about brain. So protect your brain. You say avoid pharmaceuticals, avoid medications that dampen brain function. So that's sort of a big category. What are some of the categories or common categories of medicines that people are prescribed that dampen brain function that we often don't know about or medical professionals don't really tell people about?
Yeah, I wrote an article many years ago for Better Health While Aging about four types of medication to avoid if you're worried about your brain. And I wrote it in part because I'd been at a social event and an older person told me that he felt like his memory wasn't what it was, but there's nothing to do about it. And I was kind of horrified because, of course, there are things to do about it, namely make sure you're not taking medications that slow your brain function and that, you know, could contribute to worsening brain health. And so many people don't know that medications such as Benadryl, and there are many others that tend to give that side effect of dry mouth and sleepiness, they are what's called anticholinergic. So that's a whole group of medications that are available both over the counter and in many commonly prescribed medications, such as medications for overactive bladder or certain medications for back pain. So I found that older adults are often really interested in realizing that a lot of these commonly used medications are slowing their brain, and that that's something they can do to be proactive is identify them or ask their doctors or pharmacists for help identifying them and minimize their use of them. So that's one category. And then some of the others that people should look out for are sleeping pills. So like Ambien, sedative tranquilizers, things like Valium or Ativan. And then a less used category in general would be things like antipsychotics. In geriatrics, we see those especially used in people who have a dementia such as Alzheimer's and are having difficult behaviors. But, you know, sometimes other older adults are taking those as well. So I like to really focus on helping people learn about the anticholinergics. I know it's a big, long word that a lot of doctors don't like to use, but we do have an article and now a YouTube video about seven common types to help people spot them so they know which ones beyond Benadryl and medications for overactive bladder to look out for.
Okay, you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Leslie Kernison, who is the founder of Better Health While Aging. She is a board-certified geriatrician, and you can find information on her website, which is just one long word, betterhealthwhileaging.net. She's also the author of the book, When Your Aging Parent Needs Help. And we're going to get to that in the sort of the second part of the interview. But we're talking about Leslie Kernison's sort of top 10 list for things that folks can do to try to optimize their aging in 2022. And we just talked about avoiding medications that can dampen brain function. But then you have another one here that I think probably is more for the medical providers in the audience, but deprescribe. What do you mean by deprescribe?
Yeah, so deprescribing is this idea of looking at medications and thinking which ones can we maybe stop and might not be necessary. So we know that as people get older, they tend to take many medications. And what I think older adults and families don't realize is that often those medications are not strictly necessary, and that they're often there due, honestly, to a certain inertia. You know, where providers tend to not rock the boat and just leave things going, or sometimes some of them have been added after hospitalization, or some older adults are seeing many different providers or many specialists. And so in our work in geriatrics, we're usually very intentional about looking at medications and trying to peel them off, because as people become older and frailer, they're even more likely to experience side effects and adverse events from them. Although I should emphasize that the CDC has estimated that every year there are, over 150,000 older adults who visit the emergency room due to a medication issue. So, it's not just for, say, nursing home patients. So it's considered good practice for all older adults to kind of work with their providers to review all medications at least once every, I would say ideally every year, perhaps every 2 years, and look at them and ask themselves, is this still really necessary? What are we using this for? Is this still a good way to manage the problem? I mean, earlier we were talking about the anticholinergic medications that affect brain function. They definitely slow down brain function. And what's interesting is many of them are prescribed for symptom problems and don't even necessarily work that well. And there are often other ways to manage the health condition with either a safer medication or, a non-pharmacological method. So there's been this idea in the better prescribing, community. That's an aspect of quality improvement in healthcare that we should try to deprescribe things. And so I encourage older and adults and families to be proactive. And the way they can do that is have a good list, make sure they understand what each medication is for, find out if any of them are on what we call the BEERS list, which is a list maintained by geriatricians of medications that older adults should avoid or use with caution. So all those memory affecting medications are on them, are on the list. And if a medication is on the BEERS list, it's to have a conversation with the doctor about, like, okay, do I really need to keep taking this? Or could I be on less of it? Or is there another way that we could manage whatever this has been prescribed for?
Okay, the next recommendation is one I'm sort of going out of order here, but I like this one because it's sort of more mechanical and less, perhaps less cerebral, which is if you have high blood pressure, get yourself a home blood pressure monitor and record blood pressures. And that sort of sounds commonsensical, but when I started in medical practice, very few patients could take their own blood pressure. They used to have to certainly go to the doctor's office, or they could. I thought frequently go to drugstores was a place that they often did, and then they sort of took those away. But now it seems like more and more people have devices or fairly inexpensive cuffs they can use at home to monitor blood pressure. What do you recommend here?
Well, I think, as we know, it's a really common chronic condition for older adults is to have high blood pressure and to be on medication for blood pressure. And so what the research shows is that when older adults sort of like supplement the office blood pressure readings with their home readings, we, as their healthcare team, often have a better, more accurate understanding of what their blood pressure is. And then we can work with them more effectively to get it in a good range. So it's again another way to kind of be an active participant in one's healthcare. I also find that a lot of older adults are taking too much or too little blood pressure medicine. And I think that's in part because many of them are only going to the doctor and getting it checked, two, three times a year. So now, if, as you said, now more and more people have a monitor at home, so the next thing is to actually use it. And I recommend people check once a month to kind of have, a baseline. And then, especially if there's been a change in their blood pressure medication, or it seems like it's high, it's to, check every day for like a week or so to kind of confirm that whatever medication change has been made is working okay, before you go on.
Okay, now this is one you've, I think, written a lot about, which is have your own health record, right? So, we get pretty if we go to a medical doctor's office or a provider, they keep documents, they write notes, clinical notes. They do it on a computer nowadays, by and large. And there are these electronic files with our medical records in them. And it's somewhat surprisingly hard to get these. You're entitled to them because they're really your records, but there are sometimes hoops to jump through, forms to fill out, sometimes fees you're charged. But you're saying keep your own health records. How do you recommend going about that for folks?
Yeah, so basically, this is about keeping your own copies of your own essential health information. And So the simplest way, like one simple thing that people can do is when they have blood work done, they can ask their doctor, can I have a copy of the results? And depending on how the clinic is set up, sometimes it can be set up so that when it's ordered, the patient will be mailed a copy of their results. Or the doctor can just, you know, have their medical assistant, you know, photocopy it in the visit and you have it there. Or if you get some kind of scan or special test done, you can ask for a copy of that. So that is how I would recommend people do it. Now, people sometimes think, well, like, why do I need to do it? And I think it can be helpful if you ever need to change doctors, if there's an urgent problem, or if you ever decide to learn more about your own health and start kind of looking into it, you should have that information. So it's often, you know, been striking to me that people, if they have something in their house fixed, right, they keep a record of it. But when something in their health is done, they often don't have a record. So I've had family members tell me, well, I think there was, you know, something this or that on my colonoscopy. And I said, well, what was it? Oh, you know, well, I'm not sure because, you know, again, they don't have that record. So I think it's, again, a way to be proactive and engaged and can also help compensate for our healthcare system, which is often not as efficiently connected as people think it is. So,
but if I switch doctors, here's the example. If I switch doctors or if I go to a specialist, they just have all the records, don't they?
Well, depends on whether the doctor you switched to or the specialist is in the same health system as your first doctor.
Right.
but otherwise, sometimes they get the records, sometimes they don't. But, you know, there's this idea of patients being less passive in their healthcare experience and more kind of active participants. And I think to do that, the average person, you know, is not going to become a doctor, but can still learn, you know, to look at their records somewhat, or at least have them so that they're able to bring them to someone else if they ever need a second opinion.
Okay, one more from the list, because we won't get to all of them, but an important one: socialize, contribute, nourish your soul. It seems self-evident to socialize, but explain what you mean by nourish your soul or contribute. How are those beneficial when we age?
Well, you know, I think the body-mind connection is really real. And that when we do things that, that first of all, being connected to others and feeling a sense of belonging and mattering and meaning is very important and actually does affect our health and the way our, you know, physical cells are operating. And it also just feels better to live life that way. So, and we know it matters a lot for older adults. So I think it's just, yeah, it seems kind of obvious, but I think people sometimes think, oh, that's nice to do and it means I'll enjoy my day to day, but it's a reminder that it's not just helping you enjoy your day to day, but it's helping you maintain your brain and your body so it can work the best it can as you get older and possibly even slow down certain age-related changes. So especially with the pandemic having, you know, made things more challenging, I think it's been a good time to for us to all reflect on what's most important to us and how can we bring more of that into our lives.
Well said. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Leslie Kernison, who is a board-certified geriatrician and the founder of Better Health While Aging, a resource to learn about how to optimize or improve your health as you age. And you can learn more about it and read these articles and see lots of videos that she's created at betterhealthwhileaging.net. And Leslie Kernison is also the author of the book, When Your Aging Parent Needs Help. And Leslie, you seem to have developed a sort of a subspecialty that is, well, you were a subspecialist in geriatrics, but in people who are worried about their aging parents. And this is something that you've increasingly, I think, grown your voice around. So what are some of the warning signs or when are people who have aging parents often triggered to seek more help or get more guidance? What are some of the turning points?
Yeah, well, I think it depends, you know, on the person. I mean, certainly one of the things we saw during COVID was we saw a lot of people get very worried about their aging parents and be pretty forceful in trying to keep their parents safe in a way that I'm not sure. I know it came from a good place, but, you know, adult children shouldn't necessarily assume that it's their role to be the self-appointed protector of their parent. And that said, a lot of older adults will reach the point at which they are starting to either have some worrisome health signs or experience some declines in independence or start to show signs that are, you know, worrisome to people around them. How aware the older person is of the signs, you know, I think kind of varies, and especially will vary depending on whether there's memory or thinking that's affected or not. So adult children sometimes get worried because they notice that their parent is having difficulty with finances or seems to be getting more forgetful or seems to be having trouble driving or is having trouble maintaining the house or is having falls or, you know, just seems to not be quite as able to manage all their life tasks and what's going on in their life as they were before. And so I wrote the book in part because what I've found is that when people get worried about their older parents, sometimes it's because there really are some worrisome changes going on and, you know, some investigation and additional support is warranted. And sometimes, as people get older, they might be more vulnerable to problems, but they are still in a good position to make those decisions about what risks they want to take for themselves. And it might be the adult child's job to, you know, to a certain extent, kind of back off or really have some thoughtful conversations and learn more about what matters to their parent. Because what we ideally want to do is not push an older person we love to live the life we think they should have, but to live a life that allows that older person their best opportunities to live the way they want to. So I wrote the book to help walk people through how I think about it, because it's something that comes up for us in geriatrics, right? We either notice something concerning or we have family or friends kind of alert us and say they're worried, and we have to take a look and sort of determine, you know, start to get a sense of whether there's something there to really be concerned about. And so the book is not a substitute for getting a good geriatric care team involved, but is meant to help people with that. And then to just speak to my interest in people helping older parents. We've known each other a while, John, and I think you remember that back in the day, my website was actually called Geriatrics for Caregivers, because I was especially interested in how often older adults were supported by concerned family members, spouses, adult children, sometimes even, you know, friends or neighbors who are really playing a big role in their healthcare. And so in that way, geriatrics has some similarities to pediatrics, where there's not just the patient, but there's their, you know, their care circle, mm-hmm. Who are a really important part of the team and what is, you know, supporting that person moving forward through life. So I've always been really, really interested in that. And so at Better Health While Aging, I try to serve, you know, both older adults who want to be, who are interested in their health and how to manage common age-related health challenges, and also in supporting people who have become, you know, partners in an older person's health and well-being, or are trying to figure out how to provide more help or whether they should be providing more help.
So if someone were to find or come to a conclusion that their aging parent needed help, I mean, certainly one place they could turn is their parent's doctor or medical provider. But what are some other ideas that you have or that people can find through Better Health While Aging to address some of their concerns? Because it's not always, I mean, it is medical, but then there's like a whole kind of social service component to it to find ways to, you know, and you said like a care circle. There are other issues besides the purely medical. So what's a maybe a resource to turn? And I should hasten to say that not all doctors know about a lot of this stuff. And so it's, you know, a doctor is sometimes we consider ourselves hammer and we see a nail. So if there's a specific problem, a urinary tract infection, we can treat it. But if there's a bigger problem about whether it's the aging parent is driving or forgetful or leaving the stove on, that sometimes is difficult to address medically. What are some areas that people can turn to?
Yeah. So again, that is part of why I wrote the book. So in the book, we have these like checklists and lists of things to specifically look for to see what's a problem, because part of it is coming down to like, well, what are the specific issues that are coming up? When we identify issues, what do we think is causing it? Like, is there an underlying problem with memory or thinking or another aspect of physical health that is causing it? Because for some older adults, they just need some of that adjusted or treated if possible to then be much better. And then what are other ways that we can support them? So part of it depends on what's the specific issue and what's we think is the underlying cause. And then we bring in support to fill in for the need, you know? So if if driving is an issue, then how can we engage in conversations? Well, first of all, we need to make sure there are a lot of adult children who think their parent is, you know, tell me their parent is a terrible driver. And then when I ask, well, when you ride with them, what are the specific things you've observed? And they haven't actually done that, right? So again, you know, sometimes people are actually kind of overestimating the problems that their parent is having. Mm-hmm. You know, they've just sort of assumed that they must be driving badly because of this or that they have seen. So we again want to make sure we're not, you know, making assumptions, and that we've, you know, carefully looked. So who you can turn to, you know, it's tough. Every, you know, all municipal areas have an area agency on aging, which I think they were created by the Older Americans Act a while back. And those are supposed to be resource centers to help older adults and help families identify helpful resources. What I hear from families, because I've been running online programs for people helping aging parents for a few years now, and we also have lots of families writing to us at Better Health While Aging, a lot of families find that those agencies are not very helpful. And I think it's partly because those agencies are underfunded often. So, you know, looking for other nonprofits in the area that might have helpful resources. There's a wonderful national nonprofit called Family Caregiver Alliance. They are based here in the Bay Area, but they have a national presence. They have a cool navigator on their website where you can look up and put in your location, and they help find helpful resources. You know, if the problem is food shopping and eating, then maybe a resource might be, you know, Meals on Wheels. But it's not easy to identify all of these. So we do list a lot of them in the book. I forget if we have like other articles on the site that list those particular resources. We probably have it somewhere on the site. And then some primary care clinics are specially designed for older adults, and those often have good resource lists or sometimes a social worker or geriatric social worker, and that can be really helpful as well.
Well, the name of the book is When Your Aging Parent Needs Help, and it's written by my guest today, Dr. Leslie Kernison, who is a board-certified geriatrician and the founder of Better Health While Aging, which you can read more about and see for yourself, where there's a trove of information at betterhealthwhileaging.net. Leslie Kernison, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to talk to you again.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. John. Yeah, it was great to reconnect with you. And I wish everybody a good 2022. I do feel like things are going to get better pandemic-wise this year, and I know we're all looking forward to that.
Amen. Thanks a lot. Dr. Leslie Kernison is a geriatrician, consultant, blogger, and the founder of the website betterhealthwhileaging.net. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schuman with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.